Welcome to the Subtle Reformation Podcast. We're so glad that you can join us. I'm one of the hosts, Ben.
And I'm Stephen. And we're really glad that you've joined us to listen to us muse about formation and what it means for who and how we can be in this world.
Well, good morning again, Stephen. How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, good. The fire went out completely. So
brilliant. So you're freezing?
Well, not quite. It does take. You know, they talk about wooden fires. The good thing about wood is it warms you up twice. You know, warms you up having to split it.
Oh yeah.
And then it warms you up once you start to burn it. So because that ducted heating died years ago, and we never got it fixed because we've got one of those sort of wood stoves.
Yeah.
It heats, you know, the whole half of the house where the bedrooms are and whatnot. So, but yeah, when it goes out, when it's starting to get to the middle of a Melbourne winter, it's a bit chilly.
Yeah, very chilly.
Yes, I did that. But I also had a shower. I can't function without a shower. You know, Felisa, on a Saturday morning, if my partner says to me, oh, you know, can you get some milk from the milk bar, or you know, can you get some bread? I need to have a shower, I need to get dressed, I need to shave, she's like, it's just the milk bar. I'm like, sorry mate, I'm a wog, we kind of dress up.
I like so, that.
Yeah, so I'm fully dressed, I'm dressed and presentable, even though I'm at home and, you know, on a microphone.
Yeah,
I'm looking good for those who can't see me.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's good, looking good, except, feeling good,
except for the ISO hair. That's a bit Grizzly, yeah. Adams.
Just put a hat on and you're fine, hey?
I do. I've got my hat on.
Yeah. It's the perfect thing to just cover all hair mistakes and blemishes at the moment. It's great.
Well, how about you, mate? How are you going?
I'm doing good. I'm cruising along, which is nice. It's my day off today, so I'm looking forward to a relaxing day for all those listening at home. It's going to be good. Not going to do too much. Maybe have a little nap. Do all the good things that adult life requires of you. I know. The dream. A nap. No kids. That's why I can get away with that. So
it's funny when you're young, it's like, I want to stay up as late as I can. And then you get old, it's like, I want to get into bed as early as I can.
Yeah. And have extra sleeps during the day if I can as well.
Mate. Yeah. Are we the right people to be talking about youth and young adult ministry?
No, I don't know. Maybe not, but we're going to do it anyway. Speaking of which, let's jump into today's, conversation. One of the things that I've been really thinking about and having some questions around is this topic of accountability, particularly in, I guess, what is a season of anonymity in one way. So, you know, we're spending a lot of our time at the moment engaging online, you know, for us in our youth ministry, and what that looks like is potentially a completely anonymous experience. You can sign in and be a part of our community and watch, you know, our program and be involved in what we're doing on a Friday night. But you can just be a number on a screen that we never know a name of. And it's really complicated and difficult going, okay, what's going on in people's lives and how do we keep, you know, ourselves accountable and others accountable during this season, which I think is a bit of a difficult concept. And I mean accountability, just I think we should probably frame this from the get-go, because I think accountability often has the negative connotation of how do I stop myself from doing things I don't want to do. But also I think the positive accountability, how do I get support to do the things that I do want to do? So I guess I'd love to hear some of your musings or your thoughts around what you think it looks like for us to do accountability in this season where it's easy to be anonymous.
Well, look, I guess you know, again, I'm the most opinionated person I know. I guess before I jump into it, something that I was thinking about whilst I was listening to you is how do you think you guys were doing accountability before lockdown? What did that look like before lockdown?
Well, I think for us it was this idea of, you know, in our context, there's a lot of emphasis around this small group and life group experience. And so for us, I guess in our ministry it was probably based around that, in terms of we want to create a place where people are talking about the things that are going on in their life, are getting the support where, you know, youth are talking to leaders about things that they are struggling with, or things that they're really wanting to see happen in their life. And the leaders are there to kind of, you know, do the whole, the thing, the pray for them, support them, check in on them. Hopefully even at times provide some resources. You know, they go, hey, I've been there, done that. Here's some things that I've found really helpful. Here's some things that hopefully will be helpful for you too. So that was probably how it was done. It's always tricky in the youth context, because, you know, you're always going to be careful of, you know, boundaries and communication and, you know, keeping all of that above board. So, yeah, but that's probably what it looked like in our context. Not like we were trying to start accountability groups with, you know, group message conversations where you check in every day on how everyone's doing with their accountability goals. But there was this sense of we provide a place for people to have relationships that can provide accountability, if that's what they're looking for.
Because I guess the other question I had is, if you want to hide, you're going to hide. It doesn't matter whether you are in person or whether you are online. If, you know, if I've made a decision consciously or unconsciously not to be transparent, it doesn't really matter whether I'm doing it via, you know, Zoom or Skype, or whether I'm doing it in person. That's what sort of prompted the question. Does living in this kind of virtual way, does it necessarily give you any additional advantages to living less transparently? I'm just thinking out loud here.
Yeah, no, there's some good questions, because I think probably, I guess one of my thinkings is around this sort of space of, like, because our group isn't jumping in to, like, you know, an online video call with everyone. There are a lot of people who can, I guess, maybe avoid even just being seen or noticed completely without even, you know, trying to hide. Like I think we talked about in our, you know, episode around the digital discipleship, where, you know, you can kind of show that you're hiding by muting and, you know, having no video. But this has been something that's even a step further for me, in the sense of some of these youth, and I'm sure this is probably happening around the country, can just come and watch and then leave, and no one even knows they were there. Like it's a whole new level to it. And I'm probably also thinking of this particularly in regards to me and my leaders. So how do I help them and support them when I used to be able to see them on a Friday night and I don't know, sometimes be able to create those conversations just by, I was about to say sheer force of will, but like just being able to go, I haven't seen this person or talked to him in a while, and I'm just going to go up to him and have a literal conversation right now. And I'm just going to try and push in a little bit deep, ask some tough questions, not to try and get a rise out of him, but just to really see how they're going. Cause that's important to me. Whereas now it's the same thing. I don't know which of my leaders are on all the time. I can't just like pop over to them and have a conversation. It's raised a whole bunch of things for me. And then I'm probably thinking about it, if I'm honest as well, personally, how do I do that when I'm not seeing people face to face in the same way, and I'm getting clogged up with meetings and there's not so much, like we said before, relational focus when it comes to online meetings. There's a lot more just, we've got something to do, let's get it done. So yeah, I think I'm just asking this question in a whole variety of different ways.
It's been helpful just getting a sense of where you're coming from, particularly, you know, because part of what we're trying to do here in the podcasts is we're trying to get real life questions from people. And that's really been your task. I was just keen to try and get a bit of a sense of what really isn't a question, but a whole collection of questions.
So, yeah, totally.
I wondered whether, Ben, we've kind of alluded to our previous relationship, but perhaps just to give people a bit of a clear sense, our history. Well, you took some subjects that I taught years ago, but then you took a formation subject.
Yeah.
And the structure of that is you drive to a retreat center, often having very little idea of what the formation process is about. And then you find that you're in a group, most likely with a bunch of people you don't know.
Yeah.
There's anywhere between, four and seven or eight people in that group. There's a facilitator. I think you have depending on how it's structured, you either have an evening or an afternoon where the process is described to you, and the students generally have this growing sense of horror that they have to.
Yeah, just sheer terror.
share their life in an incredibly and it's not done anywhere else. The vast majority of feedback I get from students is, I have never done this before. I've had participants in the group say, I haven't even done this with my partner, let alone with a bunch of strangers. And for the next two or three days, you tell your story, and then you hear a whole bunch of people tell their story. And in a dictionary sense, it's the most contrived experience ever. But when you do it, you get to the other side of it, and this sense of community that has formed through this highly contrived experience, it's quite disorienting. And then that group meets periodically throughout the year. And what I do is, the very next meeting we have, which is normally anywhere between 3 and 4 weeks after the retreat, I don't tell them this, but I call that first meeting of the group, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Or was it a dream?
Yeah, or a nightmare.
Because you leave this, it's, in many respects, it's kind of forced vulnerability. Yes, you get a choice.
Yeah, you can choose how much you share.
Yeah. Well, and you can choose not to do the subject as well.
I mean, yeah, that's true.
But once you're in, like, it's there's nowhere to hide, especially if you get someone like me as a group coordinator.
Yeah.
So I thought it might be good just to give people a bit of a sense of, so you know, quite a bit of my story. And when I, when I teach my formation subjects, when I do any public speaking, I tend to be reasonably open about my life. My background is a pretty working class, I say to people, I grew up in a very working class suburb. Migrant parents. I was probably quite an anxious and conscientious kid, a little bit of a creative kid. And, technically I'm what you call a survivor of domestic violence as well. So I grew up in an environment that made me an incredibly susceptible candidate to all sorts of addictive behaviours, the anxiety and the mental health stuff that is part of the territory of growing up in an environment of domestic violence. I was introduced to pornography in a pretty diabolical way when I was quite young. Before the age where young people tend to be exposed to pornography. And this is, not the age of the internet either.
Yeah.
The internet was nowhere to be seen at this stage. So that sort of combination of, addictive factors, that kind of environment, and exposure to pornography. And then I became, I came into contact with Protestantism. And of course, one of the things they talk a lot about, but they don't talk a lot about, is sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
So, don't do it. And that's really pretty much it. But you hear a lot about don't do it.
Yeah, that's all you need to know.
Yeah. So, again, being a highly conscientious person and having a sense that, this kind of addictive lifestyle was perhaps not not on the agenda. And I think I mentioned in previous podcasts, you know, I have a predisposition to being the pessimist. I've got to work really hard to, you know, to see the good in things. I feel like I'm getting better as I get on. I think I'm pretty sure, you know, when we were in a group together and I told my story, I would have mentioned a couple of times where I tried to actually reach out to a Christian leader to talk about what was going on and just how incredibly painful that was, because the reception I got was not a gracious, welcoming, hospitable one.
Yeah.
It was quite a soul, you know, both of those instances were quite soul destroying instances, trying to reach out to somebody and talk to somebody. So that's kind of where I come from when it comes to accountability. You know, that was my sort of introduction to Christian accountability.
Yeah.
And it was probably years later I'm kind of jumping from thing to thing here. Feel free to butt in too at any point. I remember years later, this would have been after you and I had met, certainly the first time. There's a fellow who's become a bit of an inspiration to me. Again, another Queenslander, two Queenslanders.
They're good quality.
Into episodes in a row. I don't know if you've heard of or bumped into Dave Andrews. He's kind of...
I've read a couple of his books.
Oh, okay, yeah. I remember being at a conference that Dave was speaking at, and he told a story about a fella. So they do kind of super, super low church.
Yeah.
I think it's over food. It's over a barbecue. And Dave, I think, would have been, you know, in his 40s or 50s when this happened. And he tells the story about a fella in their community who came up to him and who was also in his 40s and 50s and talked about, found the courage to broach the issue of saying he struggled with an addiction with pornography. Mm. He said to Dave, look, if you were to simply to ask me, you know, hey, John, how's it going? And then, you know, Dave, as he was telling the story, sort of did this great big sort of obvious winking, you know.
Yeah.
So, hey, John, how's it going? Wink. You know, this fella, John, and obviously his name wasn't John. It was, you know, his name was changed to protect his identity.
Yeah.
John said to him, you know, if you just, even if I was on the other side of the gathering and he yelled out, hey, John, how's it going? Wink. John said, I feel like that's enough for me to gain a sense of mastery over this. Like knowing, you know, if I find myself in a situation where I'm going to do something, I feel like if we had that agreement, that would be enough to help me, you know, make some healthy decisions around this stuff. And of course, Dave Andrews, and he would be, if he heard this, he would be painfully embarrassed to hear me talk about him as being a legend. But the kind of legendary fellow that Dave Andrews is, he said, John, I will only do that under one condition. And did you want to hazard a guess there, Ben, what that condition might be?
I don't know. I'm guessing maybe that he asked him the same question.
Exactly. He said, I will only do that if you ask me the same question. And all of a sudden, there was this incredibly democratic, egalitarian, liberating.
Yeah.
This is actually what accountability is about. I think it's in James, and I think I'm quoting it correctly. You know, confess your sins one to another.
Yeah.
This is democratization. There's this, you know, I'm not accountable in a hierarchical sense. I'm accountable in a mutual sense. And of course, that just speaks of the Trinity, you know, the mutuality in the Trinity as well.
Yeah.
So I think any conversation about accountability, you have to talk about the dynamics of power because, you know, again, you know, if you don't mind me picking on you a bit.
Go for it.
Being an 8 on the Enneagram, if anyone is susceptible to the idea that if I make myself vulnerable, they have power over me. It's the eights on the Enneagram.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm kind of looking out the window while I'm talking. I'm not actually looking at you. Maybe I should have looked at you. How do you feel about this notion of mutual accountability?
Yeah.
I'm guessing you're not feeling the butterflies and the.
No, I don't super love it. That's for sure. I mean, how would I describe it? It hits me on two levels. One, when I'm looking at it objectively as a model for people to use, I go, that makes total sense. I like it. Keeps it even. It recognizes that we're all people on the journey rather than one person is my savior. And then I go, but I don't know if that's for me. I think that it does look like a good model.
I had tea in my mouth. Lifting the cup there was, I almost needed to spit my tea out. I didn't want to do it on my keyboard.
Yeah. It's definitely like that's challenging for me, that idea of, the mutual accountability. But I do think, like, genuinely, it is the better model in that sort of sense. I do feel like sometimes in and I probably feel this as, you know, a pastor kind of thing, that sometimes people will come to me wanting to talk to me about it, as if I've always got, you know, like whatever it is they want accountability for. It could just be to read the Bible more. It could be, yeah, they're struggling with, you know, losing their temper all the time or whatever it is. Then they kind of come to you going, can you keep me accountable, as if I've got it all together and I'm going to be, and you know, me holding them accountable, a pastor holding them accountable will be their savior, which definitely isn't the way to go. One thing, as you were talking about this though, is I had this random memory of our time back at Year in the Sun. So 2010. So we're going a long way back, but
my goodness, that was another world.
Yeah, wasn't it? We did some stuff. I was
being sarcastic. 10 years is not a long time for me. Oh. I'm getting old.
Sorry. Feels like a long time for me.
You young people, mate, that's a lifetime.
Yeah, that's a third of my life ago. We were doing the spiritual practices and, you know, we had a whole variety of different ones and we could all choose different ones to do. And I remember one of them was an accountability group. And I remember there was a few guys who did that each week. They'd get together and, I don't know, like, I guess confess. I think it was like a confessional group, actually. I think that might've been how it was phrased. Do you remember like teaching into that, kind of like how you framed that and what that.
Yeah, I do. Like? And a lot of it rises out of this, my own personal experience and stuff I picked up along the way. But before I kind of dig into that a bit, I did want to mention that I believe that there are still two boys groups that continue to meet to this day because of that experience at Year in the Sun.
So I've
done this quite a few times. I can't remember who did what. But I know that there are two boys groups from that sort of Year in the Sun era.
Wow.
So for those listening, that was the name of the program, Year in the Sun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are two boys groups that continue to meet to this day. Like, you know, I know one of them I'm actually really good mates with. Our family's pretty close to his family. But yeah, he still meets with a couple of the guys that he did Year in the Sun with once a month, and they do their confession stuff together.
Wow. That's cool. That's really cool. Because that for me is like a lasting memory around this idea of accountability. I just still remember being like, that is so incredible that these boys are meeting every week. And again, maybe that was just me not realizing I was an eight at the time, thinking that's the most dangerous, dumb thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But just being impressed by it.
And there's a couple of things. I want to mention a brief story about my sister, not anything she did, but something she said to me. I'll come back to that. But, there was something else I was going to say as well, but I forgot. Oh, look, if it's important, it might come back to me in a Tourette's kind of way. I'll blurt it out.
Yeah.
Yes, something I remember, because one of the other things, and I'm not sure when we did spirituality and sexuality at Year in the Sun, did I do it for you guys or did we get external people in to do that?
Nah, you did it.
Yeah, so what had happened was up until that time, there was a lady by the name of Deborah Hirsch, Melbourne, you know, born and bred.
Mm-hmm.
And she was kind of like the guru when it came to, Christian framework on spirituality and sexuality. And then I remember the Year in the Sun team realizing that she was going to be moving on. Her and her partner were moving to the US. And we were like, oh, geez, who's gonna do this input?
Yeah.
And in one of those, you know, those moments in movies where, you know, all the soldiers are lined up and it's like, you know, okay, take one step forward if you want to volunteer for this mission, and all of the other soldiers take one step back and you're kind of the person.
Yeah, yeah.
it felt a little bit like that. But I remember Rowan saying, you know, hey, so, you know, should we do it? And then I'm like, oh, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And part of it was, and part of the story I tell, and I still do it when we do sexuality and spirituality at Next. Part of this is, you know, some of the stuff I've already shared about my own background. But I remember finding myself, oh, I remembered what I was going to say. It's about the formal role of leader, pastor, and in particular, the complicating stuff around being a youth pastor or a youth leader.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to mention.
Sure. I'll write that down.
Yeah. So my partner, she was asked to be she was called to be a youth pastor. So I was the pastor's wife.
Nice.
So I didn't have a paid role. I didn't even have a position description. I was just a highly productive volunteer. And I remember the first time I had to do like a formal, you know, sex talk in youth ministry, and just being terrified because, to this day, I'm still working it out. To this day, I still feel I'm not the most, I'm the most unlikely candidate to help people talk through this sort of stuff, which is kind of the point, I think. Hearing people who have overcome stuff and have, you know, haven't struggled for 20 years, those stories tend to profoundly disempower people. And that's what kind of creates this, you know, people walking away from conversations like that or monologues like that going, well, I'm not going to try again. I can't sort of live up to that.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden I'm looking down the barrel of having to talk to a whole bunch of young blokes about things that I did and still, you know, profoundly struggle with, sexuality, your sense of identity. And I remember it was a 3-week thing, and week one, it was rubbish. Like, you know, it was a fantastic presentation. I'd researched it and any questions? No. and then, you know, week two, again, I'm aware of what I'm saying here. I put the presentation together, but it was a bloody good presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
Week two, just stone cold, nothing. Any questions? No. And I remember calling my sister because she was doing a degree at Tabor, actually, in counselling and psychology. And I told her what was going on. And I've never really spoken to my sisters in great detail about our upbringing and about impact that it's had on us for all sorts of reasons. You know, family is complicated.
Yeah.
But I remember my sister over the phone saying to me, have you told them your story? And I said, no. And she said, well, they're not going to tell you theirs. And then she hung up. And I was terrified because, the climate and the culture, not just that church, but all churches, is you don't talk about this in a personal way. You don't talk about how this impacts you personally. So I kind of got a sense that I was actually going against, the spoken and the unspoken rules about, how to do this. And I remember I just spoke very, like, I just, all of this great presentation that I prepared, I threw it out.
Yeah.
And then I just said, look, in classic Alcoholics Anonymous tradition, hi, I'm Stephen and I'm an addict and this is my life.
Yeah.
And I think I would have been in my early to mid 20s talking to a bunch of guys. Some of them were underage, like they were under, under 18.
Yeah.
And looking back on this, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you can, what this, implications. I'd really probably need to talk to somebody like you about the implications for all of that. But then again, you know, at the end of that session, you know, any questions? Nothing. I got nothing. And I just felt so exposed, you know.
Yeah, I bet.
I just felt hung out to dry. And then, of course, lunchtime Monday. So this is before the prevalence of mobile phones.
Yeah.
Lunchtime Monday, I was working in IT at the time. I got a call from one of the boys saying, can we talk about the stuff that you spoke about, you know, on Sunday? And then by the end of the week, I think 11 of the 13 boys called me and said, can we talk?
Yeah.
And it was horrific, you know, some of the stuff that, some of the stuff that came out that week, you know, these guys wanting to talk. And to think that these guys had been struggling with some, you know, some pretty full on things, and had never found anyone they could talk to about these sorts of things. But because, you know, somebody talked about their own experience, and this was, you know, over a decade before Brené Brown. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, yeah. All that vulnerability stuff.
So there's no real clues as to what to do. Then finding myself in a position trying to help lead these guys, these young guys, whilst being incredibly broken myself.
Yeah.
You know, the best material I found for that was people like Henry Nouwen and you know, classic The Wounded Healer.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody who heals.
Great book.
Woundedness. Shut up. It's a terrible book.
Yeah.
No, it is. It's a great book because we have no other choice, really, but to live our lives in this way. So so that's where, you know, these experiences of account, because, you know, the other part of, you know, confess your sins one to another, because we just, you know, we're frightened by the shocking nature of that statement. That's why we don't hear a whole lot about it.
Yeah.
You know, James is not, he's a theological heavyweight, you know. Faith without works is dead. And that's why Protestants don't like it, you know. we much prefer, you know, faith through grace, not of works, lest a man should boast.
Yeah, yeah.
And James is like, well, you know, I see your, you know, your faith without works, and I raise you faith with works, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm getting James confused with John. You know, if you say that you love God who you cannot see, but then...
Oh, you hate a brother or sister.
See, you know, the love of God cannot be in you. You know, so James and John, can you see why they don't get a lot of airplay in churches?
Yeah, yeah.
My sort of experiences came out of, you know, these kind of really painful moments. I forget exactly where I was going, but what is on my mind is I'm just wondering, you know, if I was one of your leaders, Ben, if I was one of your volunteer leaders, and this happened, in terms of policies and procedures, and you don't need to be specific to your church. I mean, if you can,
like, just in youth ministry as a bit of a
how would this go? I suspect it would probably cause problems rather than.
And that's that would be the general trend. It would cause problems in the sense of, you know, most youth ministries will have, you know, things like a position description, an expectation on, you know, volunteers, code of conduct sort of stuff, which you do need to have, particularly when you're dealing with, you know, people underage. So like all of that stuff's critically important. So in all this, you never hear that we shouldn't be doing that sort of stuff, but it does sometimes make it difficult for people who step into those positions to feel like they can potentially have those conversations because they feel like they're going to be breaching and breaking some of those expectations on them as a leader, which obviously adds a complicating factor both for them to even talk about it. And then what happens, while you're in the midst of it. And look, I think there's a lot of different factors around this. I go, look, if let's let's say this, we're talking about accountability and these sort of conversations in the more negative light. These people are struggling with some stuff that they want support for.
And I do want to talk about the other side of that as well.
But yeah, I think
we need to kind of do this bit first before.
Yeah, agreed. I think it's got more to unpack and some more issues potentially with how we deal with it and do it. But I kind of swing around this whole swings and roundabouts of, you know, in terms of philosophy, do you, you know, step the leader down, not from it with a sense of, hey, you don't meet the standards, you need to step down because this isn't good enough, but more from a, sometimes it's not the best to learn how to heal while you're still, you know, in charge and trying to present your perfect and best self every, you know, whenever it is that you have youth, you know, they're like, they're struggling with some stuff, but on once a week, we force them to put a mask on and pretend like they've got everything all together. Mm. But then there's the other swing where I go, well, we're all broken people all working through some stuff. Mm. Yours just has some bigger implications right now, you know, whether it's temper or pornography or, you know, a bit of an issue with, you know, alcohol or, you know, a whole variety of different things. Mm. As opposed to the person who's addicted to gossiping. But you know, apparently doesn't need to get like, that's not necessarily something that you get stepped down for unless you're really like, you're gossiping about the youth pastor and they're like, hey, none of that. That's it, off the team. Like,
and you're gossiping on Instagram with video proof.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct. I guess what was in my mind was, you know, having this conversation on this side of the, you know, the Royal Commission into Child Sex Abuse, you know, an older bloke with a bunch of underage blokes talking about explicit sexual things. I mean, that's classic predatory grooming as well. So there are all those implications over and above.
Very much so.
So those, I was probably thinking more about those sorts of things and mandatory reporting. And
that's where it gets, it does get extra complicated. Like, it is actually more difficult to go to a youth leader, hey, I want to encourage you to share your story with your kids so that it'll help them open up, when it's like, well, actually, I'm going to need you to tell me it first. Yeah. So I can just, because you might need to censor some parts because you've got the year 8 boys, you know,
And because I'm in a paid formal position, we need to record this conversation.
Yeah. Like, literally, we need to make sure that this is all going to be okay, both for the safety of the boys, but for you as well, that you don't overstep some lines and get yourself in a whole lot of trouble.
Yeah.
So
I want to concede, Ben, that this, you know, for the sort of people who would be listening to this podcast, we're talking about material here for them. So, and I think we've said this in previous episodes, you know, if this is kind of flagging stuff for people and you have specific questions, and I'm a big fan of anonymous questions as well, so we don't necessarily need to put your name, you know, to it. But if this is kind of creating questions for people, more than happy to think them through.
Yeah, definitely.
And again, before we sort of look at the other dimension to accountability, you know, what I've since figured out, and this has gotten me in a little bit of trouble because I think people kind of misquote me, but, you know, getting drunk and you know, sort of promiscuous sexual behavior, that's not the issue. You know, those are the symptoms. Those are pointers to what's going on in people's lives. You know, a sense that, you know, I've never felt as though I belonged. I've never felt home. You know, all of these things that we kind of tend to prioritize as being the sins, they're not the sins, they're the symptoms. They're the ways in which we try to go about deadening this, you know, incredibly profound sense of existential pain. You know, occasionally, and I need to be quite careful about this, but, you know, when I am speaking publicly, occasionally I will swear.
Mm-hmm.
I do it deliberately. Like, it's quite a tactical decision, because we've already kind of mentioned, you know, when we talk about these difficult issues, you know, particularly in churches, we get a sense of, oh, you know, there's Ben talking about how he's overcome all of these things in his life. I can't relate to Ben.
Yeah.
He's just so far ahead of me. There's no way I'm going to catch up in this lifetime. And so if I kind of get a sense that there's at least one, if not a few people who are listening to me while I'm talking and they get a sense of that, then I will deliberately, you know, I'll either swear or I'll do something to sort of, you know, try to shatter that growing perception in people's minds and have them go, oh, hang on a minute. I certainly don't swear when I'm around church people, but geez, you know, my kids can tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
I swear. So it's actually, it's to, you know, to go to work. I kind of deliberately go to work on the pedestal that people may put someone on as a speaker.
Yeah.
As someone, you know,
because sometimes you literally get lifted up onto a stage. Like the symbolism of that sometimes is like
important. I'm not going to force a confession out of you, but let me be honest. You know, that pedestal doesn't necessarily get constructed solely by the people who are, it takes both parties. It takes the person on the pedestal and the people who are looking up at the person on this pedestal to create that pedestal.
Yeah.
So I think, and I also try to, this is really difficult again, because, you know, post Royal Commission into child sexual abuse, I try to make sexual jokes as well, just to take the pressure off. So it's not like, you know, gender based.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you're old enough to have remembered Seinfeld, you know, the TV.
Oh, yeah. My wife loves Seinfeld.
Have you seen the episode where they all make a bet to see who can go the longest without masturbating?
Yeah.
And they don't actually use the word masturbate the whole way through. So they actually have this conversation about arousal and masturbation without actually using any sexual words.
Yeah, okay.
And
yeah, actually, I remember that now, yeah.
Yeah, it is in the early days when I first got the gig of, you know, having to talk about spirituality and sexuality, I'd actually play parts of that episode. You know, there's a great part in it where Kramer, he's thinking, oh, I'll win this, you know, because he's such an eccentric, quirky kind of guy.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden a lady moves in to the apartment across from his, and he can see her clearly through the window. She has the blinds open and she's constantly walking, you know, to and fro without any clothes on.
Yeah.
But she only moved in after they make this bet to see, you know, who can go the longest without master. And they're getting more and more worked up and more agitated because Elaine's in on it as well. So, you know, it's not just male masturbation, it's female masturbation.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's this scene where they're in Jerry's apartment and they're talking, and then Kramer bursts through the front door. He doesn't say anything. He slaps the $50 on the bench and then leaves. Like he's lost the bet.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's this great moment where they all laugh, and then they cut to, they're all trying to sleep, you know, so George is tossing and turning because he's filled with sexual energy. Jerry's tossing and turning and Elaine's tossing and turning. And then they cut to Kramer and he's sleeping like a baby in his bed. So that kind of humor, you know,
I try to
introduce a sense of humor about it, because it's not the issue. It's pointing to an issue.
Yeah.
You know, the way in which we, you know, we experience our sexuality can have a powerfully narcotic effect on the way we feel. So, but I want to skip to, how are we going for time, mate?
All right. Probably like maybe 5-10 more minutes.
Okay. Look, I'll kick this bit off and maybe we can talk about it a little bit more in the next episode, but
yeah.
I'm pretty sure I picked this up from the Anglicans. I saw it in like in a prayer book or something.
Mm.
They talk about confession, and I think it's, you know, the Anglican statement of faith. You know, what is the chief end of man? Sorry if you're a female listening to this, it is written in misogynistic language. You know, what is the chief end of man? And it's something like to enjoy God and worship Him forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of grew up nominally Catholic and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Enjoy, like, get behind me, Satan, kind of thing. And as I kind of explored this notion of, you know, confession and enjoying, man, and I'm pretty sure I stole this completely from the Anglicans. Lisa and I were leading a church for a while, and we made confession one of the five practices. So we made our church about what we did, practices, not, you know, statements that we agree with, but things that we agreed collectively to do.
Yeah.
And one of them was confession. And what we, and it was very specific. So, you know, if you want to be a member of this church, you need to participate in these behaviors. And they were very specific. And one of the five practices was confession. And mm-hmm. It was to do with inward transformation. So we, you know, if you want to be a member, you have to actively participate in your own inward transformation.
Yeah,
and
cool.
To do that, the practice was once a month you had to sit with somebody and you had to make your confession, and your confession was how you had offended God that mm-hmm. month, and also how you had brought pleasure to God.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And guess what everyone struggled with?
How they brought pleasure to God.
Pleasure to God, yeah.
Wow.
Not long after starting that church, we had a whole bunch of kids turn up. Like little kids, so parents with kids, and we made, and so the practices for the adults were not the same for the kids. There was
very,
so what we did with the kids, and this was probably my reaction to a whole bunch of stuff that I'd grown up with, but we encouraged the kids to practice confession, but only the second part, not the first part, because we thought they've got the rest of their lives to be guilty.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, the first thing we want people to know is that, you know, God is incredibly hospitable.
Yeah.
And God is home. You know, God is where you belong.
Yeah.
And so we encourage the kids to make their confession. And so what we did was,
that's cool.
The practice was parents would ask the kids, how have you made God smile this week?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And it's tragic because, you know, kids really quickly, you know, once they have, you know, less than 15 seconds contact with the world beyond home, you know, they learn how to hate themselves pretty quickly. Well, yeah. You know, a lot of families teach them that before they have contact with the wider world because of our own issues. So this idea of being invited in to consider, how did you make God smile? And I remember we would do it around, when our kids were younger, we would do it around the dinner table, you know, have you made God smile? Or when they did something, we would actually say, you know what, I reckon you're making God smile right now.
That's cool.
So that was, so we kind of apprehended that. You know, how have you made God smile? And I remember in our church, we had a blokes group. And it got quite big. It got to about a dozen blokes, and we didn't want to split it up. Like, we didn't feel it was too big to split it up, but we were starting to lose that sense of intimacy.
Yeah.
So we actually broke the group up into groups of three, and as it turned out, again, bit of an Enneagram joke. I was a one. I ended up in a group with two other blokes. Both of them were called Ben.
Oh, nice, great name.
And both of them were fours. So we did this thing very, very similar to the ACOM model. Except we took a year. So once a month on a Thursday night, I think it was, you had the whole night to tell your story. So it wasn't an hour. You actually had the whole night.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
If you're listening to it.
Yeah. That's right.
And again, you know, some of the guys really struggled, but you know, again, I went first because I was really convinced of the, you know, of the model of the approach. And we had some profound stories of brokenness, of grace, of beauty. But what we did when we broke the guys up into groups of three, we actually encouraged them when they met in your group of three, which was every other fortnight.
Mm.
And I kind of came up with it on a whim. I took my group of three and we drove to St. Albans where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually drove them around the neighborhood in which I grew up. Like, I drove them to the house.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And I drove them to my primary school and my secondary school. And so we actually spent a night in our accountability group, you know, I'm doing that thing with my fingers, accountability.
Yeah.
And then we, and because St. Albans has changed a lot, it was very European migrant, you know, like Italian, Greek, Maltese.
Yeah.
And it's changed quite a lot. At that time, it was quite Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's become sort of, you know, Horn of Africa.
Yeah, okay.
Subsequent ways. But at the time when we were running the church, there was quite a Vietnamese, a strong Vietnamese presence in the community, still is today. And I remember after we drove them around, we sat at a Vietnamese restaurant and had dinner together. And I said, oh, you know, it's time for us to sort of do our confession, you know, as part of our group of three. And these two boys, God bless them, I've got an eternal debt of gratitude I owe both of them. They said, look, we've been talking, Stephen. Ben and Ben had been talking. And they said, we feel like for the rest of the year, because it was about March, they said, for the rest of the year, we feel like that it would be wrong for you to confess how you've offended God. For the rest of the year, we believe that you just need to focus on how you have brought pleasure to God. And again, wow. as a one on the Enneagram, it was probably one of the most profound and transforming invitations for me to consider not all of the things that I've done wrong, but how have I gotten it right? And again, yeah. I'm looking at your face and the cringe on your face because we know each other, we have history together. How much of a big deal that was to me. And I figured this is probably something that all people struggle with, you know, how have they made a positive contribution beyond the superficial, you know? So accountability, and that really started to change our men's group as well, our blokes group. So we talked about, and we frame it in terms of, if you join this group, we are going to hold you accountable to do the good in this world.
That's how good. Can we,
and consequently, all of the blokes groups I've been in from that time since to this day, that blokes group in particular, that actually divided and became two groups. And then we wound up that church after about 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
The second group still runs. Rowan's in that group, Rowan Lewis.
So oh, wow.
Rowan, yeah. But the group that Rowan was originally in and I was in together, I think we had about 12 guys. 9 of them changed careers.
Like really?
They went back and they did different study. They transitioned from one career to another because the highest value we held was, we are holding you accountable as a man to do good in this world. And so when guys talked about the sort of work they were doing and the kind of jobs, you know, the question was, well, why? And how does that contribute to making this world a better place?
And so they would shift careers because they felt like moving from this job to this job will bring more, you know, good and do more of the right that God seeks for us to do.
Because the highest value was, we are holding you accountable to do good, not just to make a living.
Yeah. Wow.
Not just to punch a clock kind of thing.
Yeah.
And take a salary.
That's incredible.
So, you know, accountability is actually a really good thing because, you know, when you're young, you literally, in Australia, okay, mm-hmm. not in other parts of the world, but for the vast majority of young people in Australia, and I'm mindful of, you know, I just need to qualify this. I had a class on Monday night.
Yeah. We were looking
at racism and how racism influences the formation of young people. And one of my students started crying when they heard a statistic, you know, an Indigenous young person is more likely to be incarcerated than to graduate high school.
Yeah, wow.
In Australia.
Yeah.
The Indigenous population makes up 3% of the Australian population,
mm-hmm.
but they make up 25% of prisoners in the prison system.
Yeah, wow.
So I want to make this following statement with that caveat.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of young people in Australia literally can be whatever they want to be.
Mm.
If they're, you know, 12 or 13 and they want to be an astronaut, if they, you know, are in the right sort of circumstances, if they kind of work at it, they could probably achieve that. Ben, the window on you playing for the Socceroos has probably closed.
Yeah, I've given myself over to that reality.
So the older you get, you kind of have this crisis of limitation.
Yeah.
The things you can do, they close the older you get. And, you know, particularly for those of us, and I want to use the word privilege, but I want to use it really carefully because it's used to divide people.
And, yeah.
Yeah, you're a white. You're a white.
White privilege.
Privileged.
Yeah.
That's kind of, you know, the downside of privilege is when you don't realize you're privileged.
Yeah.
The upside of privilege is you are privileged. How are you going to use that privilege?
Mm.
Are you going to spend that on yourself, or are you going to band together with others and make yourself accountable to this privilege?
Yeah.
How will you use this privilege? How will you use it in such a way to, you know, leave the world in a better condition than in which you find it?
Yeah, that's
and
great.
I've just found that when we, you know, when we, and it's funny because I'm still doing formation groups for ACOM. I'll do it as long as they'll have me, you know.
Yeah.
And I've got a group, and I'm not speaking out of turn, but I've got a group at the moment. And, you know, and it's all male again this year. And, you know, they're seeing things about themselves and they're like, oh man, that's pretty ugly. And I say to them, you know, in this group, while we're together in this group, you're not allowed to judge what you see.
Yeah.
You can do that later.
Yep.
All we're trying to do right now is see it. And, you know, you've got all of the other places and spaces in your life to beat yourself up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feel guilty about it. Take it from me, it's not going to help.
No.
What is going to help is being able to see it and getting a sense of why that is the case. You know, what pain is that addressing?
Yeah.
How is that, you know, how is that a coping mechanism? How has it helped me cope
at
a particular time in my life? But how is it not actually helping me cope anymore? And what might that transformed look like? So
that's good. That's really good.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the clock. I realized I've spoken a lot, but I've had some really painful and negative and destructive experiences of accountability. And, you know, my life when it comes to accountability has been a very frustrating experience because I feel as though I've kind of had to reinvent it just to survive, to make sense. And I felt like I've kind of had to go against the trend and I've had to work really hard to find, you know, this Anglican confession and this particular take. And it sucks, like feeling like I've had to break ground. Like it's harder, like it's much easier when somebody introduces you to an idea and you're like, oh yeah,
I'll adopt that. That's great.
Then, oh, I'm stuck. Let me go back to Ben and I'll ask him for some. I mean, it sounds a bit wanky, but, you know, it's not like I'm some fantastic pioneer.
Yeah.
The stuff's there. Like the material is there.
Had to go and find it.
Yeah. And it was obscured.
Yeah.
It was like some people thought, oh, we can't let people see this. You know, then they won't feel guilty anymore. And we can't manipulate guilty people. So a lot of these experiences have been just out of sheer necessity. Like I've had to do these things to survive, to not, you know, to stop the circle of, you know, inherited generational domestic violence and dysfunction.
Yeah.
To stop the cycle, or to do the best I can to stop the cycle in my generation and not pass this down.
Yeah, it's good.
Onto my kids. That's good. I felt like I've had no other choice but to really nut some of this stuff.
Yeah. It's really, really good. I still remember one of my, and this is going to sound weird, one of my favorite quotes from you is, I still remember it from, from you and the Sun, was you said, if you don't sort your issues out by 30, they don't become like issues, they become life problems because they've just become so much harder to undo. And that's come greatly to mind for me now that I'm 29 and I go, great, I've got 12 months to sort myself out. Otherwise, Stephen says I'm stuck and I'm screwed. So
just because I'm paranoid, that wasn't actually me. That was, I think it was Father Richard Rohr.
Oh, you were quoting someone else. I just remember you saying it.
Yeah, and he says, and I'm very flattered that you would attribute that to me, but the quote is, and interestingly, I think he might actually be quoting somebody else, but yep. He said, you know, if we have not transformed our pain mm-hmm. by the age of 30, we will transmit it.
Yeah.
So if we aren't able to transform it by the age of 30, from 30 onwards, what we do is we just transmit it onto others. Yeah. I think that's what you're
referring to there. And obviously, like in all of this, there's that hope, like, you know, accountability, and there's ways forward so that we hopefully don't transmit it anywhere near as much. Mm. But yeah, I think this has been really helpful though. And, you know, like you said, you feel like you've said a lot today, but probably for me, this has been something I've just been wanting to sit into and listen to, because I feel like I haven't had huge amounts of experience around this topic. And I imagine that there's a lot of people listening who haven't had huge amounts of experience around this topic, because it is something that can be quite difficult, particularly if you are a leader. There's kind of this expectation to keep it together, to not put your problems on, you know, the people that you're leading or have influence over. Mm. And even just hearing about this is really been eye-opening for me. Mm. I loved that whole, how have you made God smile this week? You know, I'll probably rephrase it as, how have you brought God joy this week? Mm. Because I just think that refocusing on the positive is so important. Mm. You know, when people say Christianity is about the rules, that's often because that's what they feel like they've been exposed to. And that's what people feel like they judge themselves by. I've either lived up to these standards or I haven't. And most of the time I feel like I haven't. So I carry a lot of guilt. Mm. But yeah, I think that framework is a really positive way forward. And I think a tool that, like, I'm just thinking for my context, that would be applicable in youth ministry, in that sort of sense of trying to reframe that for a while, instead of, you know, trying to introduce accountability and confession in those sort of contexts with, you know, what have you done wrong this week, making it difficult, but rather focusing on that positive, you know, helping people realize, you know, God actually enjoys you. God likes you. You know, God takes delight in you, you know, could be a really positive framework for our, you know, youth and youth around Australia who are involved in youth ministry context to hear, you know, to be reminded of each week, you know, God enjoyed something I did. That's cool.
I read something the other day. I may even have written something about it the other day. Again, it was Nouwen. And I thought, again, I've changed my definition of the gospel. You know, what is the gospel? It was a one-liner, and I don't think it was even the point. He was making another point, but he said, God sent Jesus to help us deal with our fear of God.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, because so often we're afraid of what God thinks of us, of what God would actually do, rather than actually recognizing, you know what, God knew all of that and he still sent Jesus so that we would realize that we don't need to be afraid of him.
Yeah, because you know, you're not an idiot, Ben. You know, What did you do wrong this week? What did you do right this week? The answer is not the point.
Yeah.
It's how you respond to that question. And it's the why behind, you know, I did this thing, you know, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, or I can't think of anything. It's the why. It's the questions help us go beyond the superficial in a dictionary sense.
Yeah.
And it's about the discipline, you know, the discipline of confession creates, it precipitates the crisis, and then it's game on. You know, once I can't think of anything I did to make God smile this week. It's game on.
Yeah, totally.
You know, well, I did this thing, and we get so caught up on the thing. And, you know, one of the questions I love, you know, very poor sense of humor.
Yeah.
One of the questions I love asking is, can you remember the first time you did that thing? And why did you do that thing?
Yeah.
The thing's not the point.
Yeah.
The why, you know, you ask that question, you ask a subsequent question, and then they begin to think about, you know, we begin to think about how we've used these things to cope.
Yeah.
What is it that you're trying to cope with? Then it's game on. Then you're in the world of transformation, and not just, you know, Christianity is a complicated reward punishment system. You know,
yeah.
We've got to move beyond that too.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, to the world of transformation. But I'm starting again when we.
No, that's good. But I think how you've ended that is right. You know, it's beyond reward and punishment. It's actually about transformation. And I loved that quote that, you know, Jesus is came to help us get over our fear of God. That's powerful.
I stuck it in my journal. It was the only thing I journaled that day. It was just, I copied and pasted somebody else's thought, but if I'll see if I can find it, maybe we can put it in the
show notes. Mm. That'd be cool. Well, mate, this has been profoundly helpful for me. I've really appreciated it just as a listener while also trying to help facilitate some conversation. I found that really, really helpful talking about some of the ways that we can use it to help us jump through, you know, negative behaviors that we're trying to overcome, but also how we can use it to be a positive, you know, tool, confession and accountability in this season. So I think that's great.
And Ben, can you and I once again ask, you know, those who are listening, if this stuff does create questions for you, please contact us. I'm sure it will create questions, and we would much rather have a dialogue than a
totally.
We'd much rather, you know, because, you know, teaching is one thing, learning is something completely different. And when we are actually engaging with the questions that people have,
I find that
a much more exciting prospect.
Yeah, no, 100%. I agree. Like, these episodes are really just to get some content out there and see what strikes for people and what questions are raised, so we can continue to unpack them and like you said, dialogue with people and what they're really going through. So that's a good reminder. So yeah, if you've got questions, send them through. How to do that, you will find in the show notes. So just check them out.
And I'm looking out my window. The sun's come up, so I think that might be our
cue. I reckon that's the end time then. Perfect. Well, thank you to everyone who jumped on board and had a listen. We hope you found this helpful and life-giving, and we look forward to having you with us again on our next episode. But that's it for today. So catch you later.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Bye.